Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Mark.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. This is the inaugural show of Hollywood and Horsepower. You're the very first guest, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this. I know it's not exactly your favorite thing, but I appreciate you doing it.
No worries. Let me get back
to
the
truck here. You had a big day yesterday.
Yeah, just had a good day. We won one race and finished third in the other one. Two races in the same day at two different racetracks with the same race car. So first time I've ever done it. But we could have doubled up and got the broom out. Just didn't quite actually, we were good until the last restart. And we were running, I think, third or fourth and just kind of got a bad restart. So.
So that's the first time you've ever done that.
First time I've ever run two races on the same day at two different racetracks with the same race car.
Okay.
I mean, we
so
race,
for anybody
we,
just we, joining us, this is Ryan Newman. He's a NASCAR driver. And what series are you in now, Ryan?
That was a Smart Modified Tour. So it's like a NASCAR wheeling type tour modified. Only.
And you're with them for the entire 24 season, correct?
Yes.
So. Yep. I wanted to take you back. You know, everybody, most people know your career pretty well, and I know you've probably done countless, you know, talks on that. We can talk about anything you'd like to, but I'd like to kind of go back to the beginning, you know, and kind of tell people a little bit more about how you got started and what it was that really got you interested in it. So you grew up in South Bend. What was the earliest thing that got you interested in racing?
My dad and my mom, but my dad mostly. My dad always wanted to be a race car driver. Long story short, never got the opportunity. And then when I came into this world, he wanted – his goal was my goal. So, you know, I didn't know at the point, you know, that racing was going to be for me, but he gave them a shot for me to do it, and that's just kind of what I did.
So where did you start out at? Like, what was your first – thing you started? Did you start like in kart cars, or what would you?
I started racing quarter midgets when I was 4 and a half.
Wow. And from there, you know, you did that for quite a while, and then what did you go to from there?
Quarter midgets, and then midgets, and then midgets and Silver Crown and sprint cars and USAC, and then eventually got my opportunity with Penske Racing and NASCAR to do some ARCA racing.
How did that come about? Like, did they see you race, or did you approach them?
Say it again.
How did that come about, like, your opportunity? Did they see you racing, or did you approach them, or how does that usually work?
I had built a resume and had won some races at USAC and just basically got the opportunity. They were looking for, you know, the next Tony Stewart and the next Kenny Irwin and the next, you know, guys that were moving up, so we got an opportunity to do some ARCA racing because they had, and at the time ARCA racing was, you know, basically a NASCAR cup car with different tires and a different spoiler. So
okay.
It made it easy when they had some older cars that were sitting around and, you know, they didn't need their best at the best. They just, you know, we took what we needed to do to the racetrack to be competitive and did that.
So when you first started and you first get going, which series did you like the best? Like, what did you enjoy the most?
I'd say in general, my experience in pavement midget racing was probably the best. We had a great run of wins, 9 wins in a row, I think, at one time at Winchester Speedway. So that was pretty special in itself. And those cars and those types of tracks that we raced at were so much fun. So. That was kind of just seemed to be my wheelhouse, so to speak.
Who were some of the racers early on that got that kind of inspired you? When you look back on it, who were some of the guys that really kind of inspired you to really go after it? Besides your dad, obviously.
Well, my dad, you know, gave me the tools, and obviously my parents at the same time. My mom, you know, she was there to help support the things that I needed to do off the racetrack and on the racetrack. My dad had an auto repair shop, so I was always around cars and typically had grease underneath my fingernails. And you know, just getting the opportunity to move up and do the Penske Racing, ARCA Racing, and, and eventually our what we called the ABC schedule, which was ARCA Busch and Cup in 2001, gave me the opportunity to get a whole bunch of laps, and that was post college for me. So post getting an engineering degree and having been to college and things like that. So that all kind of tied things together. At that point, Roger Penske and Don Miller were looking for the next Mark Donahue, and I wouldn't say that I fell into their lap. I was looking just as much as they were looking. The stars aligned, and we had some success.
So when you were first starting out and things start clicking, I got to ask you, it's probably one of the things I've always wondered about, is like, what was when success kind of hits and you're kind of starting to make it big, what was the first big thing that you purchased? Like, what was the first thing you went and did?
I was terrified in 2000 when I purchased my house on Lake Norman in North Carolina, because it was, over $250,000, which is always a lot of money. I mean, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what generation you're from. $250,000 is a lot of money, and just for me, I didn't have that money. So like I had enough to make the down payment, but I needed my racing career to work out. Otherwise,
keep going.
I was gonna be trying to figure out either how to sell the house or try to make payments another way. So, fortunately, I was able to be successful and get the house paid off in a few years. But ultimately, when you come out of college and you're thinking about your first big expense of being, over $250,000 and on top of having a car and things like that, then learning about, home insurance and things like, just those types of next big steps of moving out of my parents' house was huge for me.
So that kind of brings back, you mentioned it with college. You went to school for engineering. What was it? Did you see that as tying into racing, or did you see yourself going into something with like automotive engineering after racing?
So I met with two different drivers on purpose. I actually met with Ken Schrader when I was racing indoors in the Hoosier Dome in Indianapolis years ago. And then I met with Jeff Gordon when he was tested at the Brickyard. I think it was prior to the inaugural race in 93, if I remember right, at the Brickyard. I asked them, what would you do? Would you go, if you had a chance to do your deal all over again, would you go to college? And they both said yes. And then I asked them what they would do. Schrader said something, to do with the chassis and, developing suspension and things like that. Gordon said something similar. So I literally went to school as a engineer in freshman engineering, figured out how to be, basically you have freshman engineering and then you declare a major the second year. I declared to be a mechanical engineer, realized that wasn't exactly for me, and created my own plan of study in a program called vehicle structure engineering. Sorry, in a program called interdisciplinary engineering. And the exact title was vehicle structure engineering, which kind of fits right into the NASCAR world. So that's kind of how my away from the racetrack NASCAR life started.
Okay. So it kind of brings us up to another thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, and anybody that's just joining us, we're with NASCAR driver and modified driver Ryan Newman, and talking a little bit about his career and what, he's done outside the track. So, you bought the house in Lake Norman. At what point did you get interested in, like, the farm and wildlife and getting into that?
So I always kind of was. So I grew up in South Bend, Indiana on 5 acres, and we raised our own beef. They had a little apple orchard. I mowed all the grass. That was just kind of like the son's duties at the house, right? But I didn't realize the impact of those things until I moved away, and my desire to kind of reconnect to those things after I moved down to North Carolina. So that was really what kind of happened there. I mean, my grandfather on my mom's side was more of a not a horticulturist, but like enjoys gardening and things like that. And my dad's dad was an auto body repair man. So you put all those things together, kind of makes, I guess, a farmer.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was your first group of animals that you acquired?
I got two Santa Gertrudis bulls, just because I saw them at the county fair down here. Had a farm and figured out, you know, just to have them as pets. And then one of them was friendly and one of them was not. And then I ended up, and I had kids, and I realized that having kids and being bull is not a good recipe. So I ended up getting rid of the bulls, and I had reached out to a friend about if he hadn't acquired or had an opportunity to acquire any more buffalo to let me know. And I ended up getting some buffalo out of Alabama. I don't even know what year it was, maybe 2007 or 8, something like that. And then eventually got some black Angus cows, and now I have elk. So I have black Angus cows, elk, and buffalo. I've got 34 elk, 16, maybe 17 buffalo. We had one that was getting ready to pop before we left the farm, and then about 75 black Angus cows.
Oh, wow. And then you're still avid hunter, avid fisherman. You know, you do quite a bit to not only encourage the sport, but you're also pretty good about being a responsible hunter. And you also go back and forth between there and Tennessee, don't you?
Yeah, I've got some. It's not my property, but I have a friend that eventually passed away, and he's got quite a bit of land and help manage that land. And Tennessee's a little bit different than North Carolina, where you can't exactly feed and do the things the way that we do in North Carolina. But you can also, you know, just be a good steward of the land and help manage and just keep track of predators and things like that that are a big part of having, you know, a good deer herd and things like that. So yeah, I enjoy the outdoors. I love the outdoors, and it's beyond a joy. But the hunting, the fishing, just, you know.
And you've
being outdoors
in.
Seeing the sunset up in the mountains of North Carolina or in Tennessee is really pretty for me. So like every part of it I enjoy.
And you've put quite a bit into improving the herd too. You know, I know you've dabbled with different types of feed and different types of nutrients and things for the animals. You still deal with that quite a bit, don't you?
Oh yeah, yeah. Keeping the animals fed well is very important. Having a good balance of protein and fiber and the things that they need to, minerals and whatnot to, be healthy all year round. So, you know, when it comes time to the elk calving and the buffalo calving and the deer fawning and things like that, and sometimes you get into situations where you've got to look at some of the things that they go through on parasites and whatnot to help them to worm them and things that are important, not just for their lives, but for their offspring. So like even in North Carolina, we've had some major tick problems. And, I've had deer and elk and buffalo that have had, you know, ticks on them that are just unbelievably bad. And treating those animals and taking care of them is something that they can't do. So as humans, we have to step in and be a part of that program.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of being a responsible sportsman, too, is to, you know, watch after, like you said, be a good steward of the land and of the lakes and whatnot, everything that you're working with.
So, yes, absolutely. The land is important, but the animals that live on the land are equally as important. And, again, when it comes to predators, when it comes to illnesses and things like that, you know, we have the ability, we have the technology to step in and make a difference. So shame on us if we don't.
So what's next at the Newman Farm? Do you have other plans for additional wildlife to join the herd?
Well, I got another little piece of property that I put some audat on. In the state of North Carolina, you can have sheep / antelope without having a permit. So there are several different species that you can do that with, but audad are the most economical one to get started and do something like that. So I've started a little bit of that. We've brought in 6 females and 1 male, and we had a couple of offspring this past spring. I'm thinking that coyotes got to them because they just disappeared, and they're not in a place where I can keep my eye on them. It's not like it's a little pen; it's a fairly big area. So don't know exactly why they came up missing, but that's just kind of a part of it, and that's why we keep our eyes on the predators as best we can.
yeah, part of managing it. Where are they native to?
I can't remember to say specifically if it was India or Africa or where it is, but I want to say they're Asian, but I'm not 100% sure. I get Neil Guy and Awdad and all those other sheep mixed up sometimes.
Sure. I was curious. So where did yours come from?
Mine came from in New Jersey.
Okay, a farm.
Which is different than India or Africa.
Yeah, did they come with gold chains and jerseys, or are they just outside jerseys for sheep?
Say it again.
Most of the guys in Jersey I know. I'm Italian, so you run into guys in Jersey. They usually get gold chains and jerseys on.
Yeah, no, these sheep don't have any gold chains.
So jumping around a little bit, you know, one of the things that I'm sure a lot of people remember is, you know, the accident at Daytona, which thankfully, you know, you lived through and everything turned out okay. But, you know, I think something that a lot of people don't realize is your involvement in the safety, you know, equipment and some of the changes that were made that actually, in turn, if I'm not mistaken, saved your life.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the process is, I mean, I have been my own crash test dummy. I've been fortunate to live through a lot of that stuff, but, you know, there's a lot of credit that goes to other people that, you know, so when they talk about a Newman bar and a chassis, it's not something that I designed and put in. It's because of a crash that I had, but obviously had some kind of input and, you know, made some communication about what was going on and, you know, how to make things better. So NASCAR in general has done a very good job of stepping up and developing some of those things. They've missed the boat on some other things as well, so I'm not going to pat them on the back with both hands. But at the same time, I get more credit from the outside than I deserve. But ultimately, it's a team sport, and you know those things are, you know, we're reactive instead of proactive, and I think that in my case and some of those things, we've been reactive, and fortunately we're reactive to a situation where I was able to live through some of these crashes and that happens over time, right? When you're going fast or doing something that's out of the ordinary, you're going to have the extraordinary happen, and that's typically sometimes catastrophic. So it's you know, happy to have made a difference and hopefully make a difference for, you know, other drivers in the future.
So how did that come about? How did you end up getting involved in the safety side of it? I've heard different recounts of the story, but I guess you and I have never actually really talked about it. And I was just curious how you got involved in it to begin with.
Mostly just because I care. I mean, they made some decisions on their own. Like I said, I give majority of the credit, no doubt, to them. But at the same time, you know, they take the input of not just me as a driver, but other drivers when it comes to those types of things as well. So, you know, just whether it's a bar or a helmet or, I mean, I owe the majority of, you know, that Daytona crash, in my opinion, goes to a friend of mine who used to work at Simpson Race Products, and she got me on a new Stilo helmet, which was the latest, greatest carbon fiber helmet that you could ever have. And it's such an expensive helmet that if I had to pay for it, I wouldn't have. Thankfully, my relationship with Bill Simpson and Simpson Race Products that had gone on for, you know, basically 35 years, that paid off because they gave me the helmet that saved my life, in my opinion, you know, when I was hit in the head by another race car going 180 miles an hour. So, you know, those things there are things that you'll never forget, even though you can't remember the crash.
Yeah, and it was, I have to say, you know, unfortunately, I remember the crash oh too well. In fact, it's ironic. That was kind of, you know, I haven't really watched too much of it since then because there's nothing worse than watching a friend cartwheel down the track. But it is phenomenal to see you go through it. Simpson is an amazing product. I raced SCCA myself and always use Simpson. All my stuff was Simpson. Great products. Same as you. Absolutely believe in them and trust them completely. and they've always been pretty phenomenal. Speaking of that, and I don't know if it's out of bounds to talk about this, but some of the sponsors that you're working with now are pretty interesting. One in particular is the Coolers, and I don't want to mispronounce their name.
You can say it like it sounds.
Say it like it sounds. I got to tell you, I absolutely love it, that I think it's one of the coolest things to have a company called Shitty Coolers.
Yeah, they have an interesting marketing strategy. They started off, I'm going to say, a couple, two, three, 4 years ago now, with a marketing strategy back when the pandemic and all that stuff was going on, and they basically were giving away stickers. You know, when the whole deal was, what kind of cooler do you have? I got a Yeti, I got an Arctic, I got whatever, and you would say, I just got an old Shitty Cooler, right? Like, well, Shitty Coolers was the sticker that they put on. And it's, you know, it's spelled differently, but it really kind of means the same thing. And I'm not exactly, I'm a churchgoer, so I try to watch my language. But in the end, this is a play on words, I guess you could say. And I feel like nothing is derogatory about it. Like it's not like you're talking mean about somebody. It's just a descriptive word talking about, you know, what kind of cooler you have,
but it is pronounced like it looks.
Just like it looks. And now they've created a brand, and they've created coolers that are called Shitty Coolers, and they're mostly just travel style, you know, kind of like backpack style coolers. If you're going to the game with your wife, your buddies, your kids, or whatever, you put a 6-pack in one, you put a 12-pack in another, whatever it is, and you can take care of the activity for that day. This isn't you're going out on the ocean and you need to pack a fish in it, and then you need another one for ice, you need another one for drinks. This is a little different, but Shitty Coolers has started off with a sticker and a program and a marketing strategy, and now is a legit cooler company.
It is pretty cool. So who are some of your other sponsors? We could actually mention them, throw them in here. I mean, they've been good to you, so we should be a little, you know, returning to them.
Yeah, I've had a long-standing relationship with the hydraulic company, who's obviously a race fan, but I also appreciates my engineering background and things like that that kind of tie into, you know, how they do business and what they do for a business. So Aggressive Hydraulics is up in Minnesota. You know, my farm life helps, you know, transfer over some of the things that I do and work on. So, I mean, they've been gracious enough to help rebuild some of my hydraulic cylinders for my skid steer in my tractor. Turns out running, you know, 180 miles an hour into a dirt pile is not exactly good for the hydraulics. So I've had to back off my pace a little bit, but company like that, company like Montrose Molders, who is a plastic injection molding company up in the Jersey area. They jumped on board and support my modified team. Capital Auto Group is a current one that basically I do some spots here. They're a North Carolina auto group dealership group, and they've helped me out a lot. So I'm still tied in and connected with Ford. So what we do with Capital is through their Ford dealership, which helps me in more ways than one. And I've been fortunate to jump on the bandwagon of a friend of mine that passed away in a midget crash. His name was Brian Clausen, and Driven to Save Lives is all about organ donation and about, you know, making the right decision for yourself, but ultimately for your family or somebody else to be able to save their lives through organ donation, organ tissue donation, you name it. So it's Indiana-based, which is home for me, and it all makes sense. We, you know, you only get so many opportunities to sign up and say that you're an organ donor in life. The second thing is you can take that opportunity and figure out how to do it yourself, but typically we get that opportunity to do that when you sign up to get a driver's license. Well, once you do it, it's kind of done. Like, you don't think about that later in life, and they bring it to relevance. And you know, we've worked with the state of Indiana to add it into hunting and fishing licenses and things like that to just give awareness for the people out there that you know, when part of you is done, it's like a junkyard, right? Some of you can go to somebody else and get reused because the technology's out there. So, you know, those those relationships are fun and make a big difference.
Absolutely. And that was actually where I was going to go next, was the Driven to Save Lives. I'm glad you brought it up, because I know that's one that's important to you. And I also know that it's been a big deal. It's a good cause, and I know you've been a real active part of it. The next question that I'm sure everybody's wondering is, what's next? Where are you headed from here? Next week, but I mean career-wise, where do you see yourself going?
The one other sponsor I should mention is Buzz E-Bikes, because technology and being mobile. Like for instance, my nephew who's just starting college, Buzz E-Bikes is one of my sponsors, but I was fortunate enough to get him a e-bike so that he can go to college, because when I was at Purdue, I knew how beneficial it was to be able to be more flexible and more mobile. And it's only easier, whether you're lazy or not, it's only easier when you have electricity at your fingertips. So things like that, being able to
I keep checking the porch
family.
For my e-bike to show up.
But you never send me your address.
I will do that. No, those are pretty cool. I mean, I've seen yours, and I've seen, they're really cool. And they're, those things are really gaining in popularity, too. I mean, you see them everywhere.
Well, yeah. I mean, my youngest daughter, she likes to go on bike rides, and our bike rides anymore are just a twist of the wrist, not necessarily a pedal. And
that's my kind of bike ride.
And I agree. It's a great way to enjoy the outdoors at a reduced pace. You're not running 45 or 55 down a country road looking around. You're riding at 20, 25 miles an hour, and you get a little bit more opportunity to take in the outdoors, and sometimes it's better to do that and slow down and than it is to travel through life at such a fast pace.
And that kind of brings up the next question with family. You've got two daughters, and one of them has been kind of dabbling in racing.
Yeah, my oldest, Brooklyn, she's been racing. She's we're having some little bit of a teenage drama cycle right now. So it's been, I always tell everybody, the car's been on jack stands, because literally it has been. But, she's still got the desire and wants to do that. And she's got an amazing ability. Obviously, the genetics are there. But secondly, she's really got the seat of the pants feel for driving. So my oldest likes racing, my youngest likes dancing, they're a good bit apart when it comes to the type of sport that it is, but ultimately I love the fact that they enjoy something that is not just at their fingertips in the form of a phone.
Sure. Well, and it is kind of neat to see it continue and see somebody, interested in the same sport as you. So I'm sure that's pretty rewarding in itself, no matter where it goes, just to see the interest there.
For sure.
And then are your parents still with us?
Yep. My mom's actually, I'm driving down the road right now. My mom's actually in the back seat. My dad's racing tonight down in North Carolina on the coast where I raced last night. And he's running a crate modified. But I got to get back and pick up my kids. So, he's on his own tonight. He raced yesterday with me in the morning. He ran 11th out of like 14 or 15 in his deal, the first race he's ever run in that type of car. So, it's kind of turning full circle between me racing,
that's what I was
my dad
say.
Racing,
kind of come around
racing.
Where you've been able to make his dream come true.
Yep. Yeah. He always wanted to race, and he basically jumped behind the wheel for the first time on his 70th birthday. So,
that's great.
Yeah, it's probably best if I keep him on the racetrack and off the road.
Well, nothing wrong with that. Well, we really appreciate you joining us. I know you got a lot going on, and I don't want to keep you any longer than you have to, but I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been Ryan Newman, NASCAR driver, not modified. Always appreciate you taking the time, and always appreciate you. You're a good friend and a good guy.
Thank you, Mark. I've done lots of interviews and lots of shows, and you and I know each other from the things we've done in the past, but appreciate you having me on the show, and wish you luck with all the things you got going on in the future.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. That was Ryan Newman. We're going to take a little break here and talk to our political correspondent, who on this show is the devil. And then we're going to be joined by Anthony Big Ass DeVille and talk about another kind of racing, which is horse racing. So joining us right now is the devil, and he's going to bring us up to speed on the political race that we have going on.
Hell, no. Garlock, yeah, no, keep shoving that badger in Jeffrey Epstein's ass. I got to go talk to this idiot. No, I'll be back. Hey, you ready?
So the devil joins us today in studio here. High atop the Gorlock studio on the Marmalayer. Yeah. What do you think of the political races coming up here?
Well, you know, let me just interject. I don't know this Newman guy you talked to.
Yeah, great guy.
But he's like 5'10".
According to Wikipedia, yeah, but I don't think that's what it means.
Okay, I don't follow you.
Yeah.
But either way, I mean, he's got the height advantage. I don't want to get off
it's
on this.
True.
Anyway, I'm sorry, what were you asking?
Your political views. You're supposed to give us a recap on the political race. I mean, you're kind of the author and creator of everything politics from what we understand.
Absolutely.
I could see that.
Yep.
Congress is some of your work, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. On a daily basis, I like to interject as much mayhem, stupidity, ignorance, denial of any plausible.
Logic.
Pretty much just hate and discontent.
Yeah, that seems to be your calling card.
Yeah, yeah, because, I mean, without it, what would we have?
Yeah,
peace.
There's peace and tranquility. Yeah, can happen.
Yeah, not going to happen.
No place for that here.
No, no. But Biden, I'm...
That's some of your finest work.
It is. I'm actually a ghostwriter for many of the speeches.
I can see that.
Upstairs.
Not since polio. Well, you had, yeah.
You know, I did some of my finest work, actually. Polio, I did, are you familiar with HOAs?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my
pretty
idea.
Much anything that ends in a PTA, HOA.
Yeah. It's handiwork that, you know, other than, you know, Pol Pot and Adolf Hitler.
Fine print.
It's some of my finest work.
Aren't you the guy that invented the capsule packaging that
you
can't
open.
Get them open?
You can't open those on
you're sick
cap.
As a dog and you can't get the
you
package
can
open. Yeah.
It's not going to happen. You're probably going to die of something before you get that packet open. I mean, you can work like a dog, but it's not going to happen. What a lot of people don't realize, I didn't know this either, was Ukraine.
Yeah.
Is a, it's a country in, what is it, Europe.
And last time I checked,
it's next to a larger
the Putin country, guy owns country. The other one. Yeah,
next to a larger country.
Putin's part of your team, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. But
yeah.
See, my objective is to I want to unburden what has been burdened in the past.
Makes sense. That seems to be your best work.
Well, it was heavily
Salem witch hunts, everything. Yeah.
That was my crusades.
Yeah,
mine.
Definitely.
I owned it.
Religion in general.
Smallpox.
Yeah.
Canned meat.
I could see that.
That was a big one, too. Because, realistically...
You must have your arm in fast food.
Yeah, who else is going to eat snouts and testicles?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but if you batter it and fry it, they don't know.
That's true.
They
people
have,
love that.
They have no idea what they're doing. But protein is protein. You can make it...
It's important to have a balanced diet.
It is. It is.
Even if you don't know what's in it.
Cartilage, fat, balloon nuts.
All
that's
right.
A big one.
That's
a hard
devil.
Sell.
All
in
right.
Fact, in my job, we actually call it the devil's onion.
I can see that.
Meets meat.
That's a family show. That we're going to keep a little.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My bad.
I know. Well, yeah. I can see you got people to take care of over there. So we're going to switch over now and get with Big A. I believe he's with us. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing
so we're
good.
Joined
just,
by Big A, Anthony Stabile.
I put my phone on mute. I didn't want to interrupt the devil.
Well, you know, nobody does. I mean, the repercussions could be horrific.
Yeah, I dealt with the devil for about 15 months, and she sounded a lot different than the guy you had on the phone, to be honest with you. But
and thanks for half your retirement, your house, and your land.
Yeah. He does what he can to bring mayhem, so generally we've all had our dance with him.
Oh, he brought the mayhem, believe me. He brought about 15 months of absolute tortured mayhem.
I thought some of that was compliments of the horse industry, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's some of the individuals.
Yeah, I completely understand.
I follow the devil. I followed Franklin Armati. I followed Johnny Embriel, Tony Kahlo at my newest gig. I've never followed the devil, Mark.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, we only get the best on this show.
And I got Facebook.
Yeah, he said, you know, you invented Facebook, didn't you? Yeah, that was his work. The for those that don't know, Anthony Big Ace DeBeal is a legend in the horse industry from my viewpoint. He has been the voice of Belmont, the voice of Aqueduct, currently the voice at Finger Lakes, the voice on numerous media throughout the industry. And we're fortunate enough to have him join us here today to talk a little bit about what he's been up to and what horse racing's doing. Again, could be tied to the devil. So tell us a little bit about what you've been up to. I mean, we haven't been able to talk a lot in the last, you know, 15 months to 2 years.
Yeah, just a long, winding road led me to my childhood dream of being a full-time racetrack announcer. I had been a backup and a part-time guy at NYRA, backing up John and Brielle for a couple of winters, and then after leaving NYRA in May of 2023, called a lot of races over at Yonkers Raceway, which is harness racing. Did some work for the Meadowlands, which is harness as well now. Freehold Raceway, I called a day there after the late, great Larry Letterman passed away. And then this job up at Finger Lakes became open early to mid-March. And after some negotiations and a couple of interesting job interviews, found my way there for opening day, April 29th of this year. And it's been amazing.
I absolutely love it.
My own announcer's booth, which is the only thing I've ever... I've wanted two things in my life, and I've wanted this the longest.
Made you want, you know, going from, you know, obviously you're in media, you've been a writer, you've been the voice of horse racing. What was it, and I know you, I remember you saying this goes all the way back to when you were a kid. What was it that made you want to be an announcer?
There's a patch of grass at Aqueduct Racetrack on the apron, right before the clubhouse turn. Me and guys and gals that I grew up with there, that I'm still friends with to this day, would play football and wiffle ball and race around the grass when we were kids. And, you know, a lot of the kids there, I would say half of them, were kids who were there because that's where their parents went for the weekend. Half of them actually liked racing and loved racing like I did. But I don't think anybody to the extent that I did. You know, my dad was a trainer. My parents met at the racetrack. My mom was a fan. So my dad was a fan and my mom was a fan. And my dad worked at the track. He was a jockey's agent and a trainer and a groom. He did everything kind of at the track, kind of like me. But I've never been a trainer officially. And I was just always enamored with the race calling. And whether it was a football game or, you know, finishing up a race, I would always make sure that when those horses were going to the starting gate, that I would stop and not necessarily watch the races, because, you know, you'd watch them, but when you're outside at a racetrack and you're on the ground level, you don't really see much going down the backstretch and on the far turn until they come into the stretch. But I would always listen. And when I was a kid, the voice here at NYRA was Marshall Cassett. And John Embriel, who was one of my mentors, and just a great friend and mentor, like I said, he was the backup here. I would always just stop and listen to them. And then in 1990, my favorite announcer, my idol, Tom Durkin, took over the day-to-day duties of the New York Racing Association and was here for 24 years. So
where was the first place you heard Tom?
The first place I heard Tom was the Meadowlands. Tom had done a lot of work at the Meadowlands as a harness guy. And, you know, he had called Hambletonians, and which is their equivalent of the Kentucky Derby harness racing trot, the trotters and paces at harness. And he had called the Hamiltonian. And I met Tom at the Meadowlands and then did a term paper on Tom when I was 13 years old. And that was, you know, kind of solidified things. The first place I ever watched someone call the race was at Garden State Park in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. It doesn't exist anymore. It's a shopping mall. A guy named Larry Letterman, who passed away in the late winter, early spring of this year. Larry had a several-year battle with cancer, and he was just a real character. And I get compared to Larry a lot, and that's the ultimate compliment, because he was a real character, and he had his own way of doing things. And I watched him call a thoroughbred race. He called harness as well. I watched him call a thoroughbred race at Garden State Park when I was 9 years old. And I knew I had wanted to do it, but when I was actually in a booth and watched somebody call a race, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. But I met Tom a few years later at the Meadowlands, and right before he had the full-time gig at NYRA, he called a couple of weeks at Monmouth Park, and I was there for a couple of those days. So it started very young, and I have had the opportunity to be in the booth watching my idols and my mentors. You know, the two guys growing up for me were Dirk and Dave Johnson, you know, one of the most famous racetrack announcers of all time. And I got to watch them both call races at the Meadowlands. And then as I got older, you know, Johnny and I became a big influence when I started working for NYRA back in 2016. And then Frank Miramati and I met for the first time at Mohegan Sun in 2014. He was doing hosting a party there that I now host most of the time. And I was doing a gig for Mohegan Sun. I was their racetrack announcer. They had these virtual electronic horse racing games that would pop up on these races that would pop up on the slot machine. And I was the racetrack announcer at Finger Lakes. I'm there now at Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. I'm talking about in just, we go back to action at Finger Lakes tomorrow. We race Monday to Wednesday until Thanksgiving Eve, November 27th, I believe that is. But yeah, Frank and I met, that then became friends. He started doing some winters at NYRA in 2017 and became really fast friends. And, you know, so I've had the honor and privilege and pleasure and the fanboy to getting to see the four guys that I idolized and, you know, have kind of mentored and tutored me and molded me. I got to spend an awful lot of time with all of them. So I've been very fortunate with that. And when you have that kind of influence, you know, when you're a kid, all my friends wanted to be baseball players. Well, I want you to imagine you're my best friend for 42 years. His name is Joe Costa. He's my oldest friend. You're Joe Costa, and you want to be Don Mattingly. You want to be the first baseman for the New York Yankees. Well, imagine Don Mattingly and Craig Nettles and Lou Gehrig coming back from the dead. I mean, we have the devil on already, so we could talk about Lou Gehrig coming back from the dead and Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio and all those guys basically showing Joe Costa how to play first base. Well, that's kind of what I had growing up in the industry. I had the heavyweights, the big hitters, not only help me along, but really push me to follow that dream.
Yeah, I don't think Lou Gehrig actually fell into your department, did he? He didn't get him. He was involved. He created some of the horse racing associations, but I don't think he had anything to do with Lou Gehrig. What was the first job that you got into in horse racing?
So I helped my dad around the barn when I was a kid and stuff, but I didn't get paid for that. I got paid in 10s and 20s and Zeppelis on the Seaside Heights boardwalk when we had the horses at Monmouth. I graduated St. John's University. I was a little bit of a big brain, a little bit of a nerd as a kid. I only went to high school for 3 years, so I was a year ahead of everything. And kind of just took a year off when I graduated college when I was 21 in 1998. And I hustled, sold some Yankees playoff tickets, statute of limitations is 25 years, so we could talk about that, sold some tickets, and just hustled, dealt some card games, gambled, played some horses. My folks threw me a graduation party for college, And I took the envelope and went to the track the next day and won $20,000 with him. So that's what I did for the summer of 98. And it's so. And at one point, my grandfather passed away in February of 1999. And I remember we buried him and we mourned him. And, you know, it was my mom's dad. And I had lived with him my whole life. He lived upstairs. We lived downstairs and kind of just had this. Mom and I had this talk like the beginning of March. She's like, you know, you're going to have to get a little bit more active now and finding a job. You took a year off, and that's great. The New York Post and the Daily News, because at the time, all the media that we have now in racing really didn't exist. It was just print. It was, you know, it was basically you had a couple of TV shows. You didn't have, like, a FanDuel TV. You didn't have Naira putting thousands of hours a year on Fox, thousands of hours of content a year on Fox. You had the newspapers, a couple of magazines, the Blood Horse. And she said to me at some one point, you know, being a lifetime New Yorker, you know, the Daily News and the New York Post just aren't going to call you. And sure enough, the week of the Kentucky Derby in 1999, the New York Post called here because a friend of mine in the press box had said they heard I was looking for a job in racing. And they were firing one guy and promoting another guy. And I started working for the New York Post on May 17th, 1 year to the day. I graduated St. John's May 17th, 1998. Started at the Post May 17th, 1999. So that was my first job.
And you were at the Post for a while.
5 years. A little over 5 years. Yeah, I did some writing for them. That allowed me to go into TV. New York City OTV, which is now defunct, had a TV show on off days for the Naira off days, when Naira ran 5 days a week, Monday and Tuesday were the off days, and I would do that show along with my New York Post duties called Thoroughbred Central, and it would go out to the New York City homes, and that was, I got my first crack on TV back then, so started to build and build and build, and then when I left the Post, it was a little bit of a fiery situation, and I kind of couldn't get a job in the industry for a while. And got back on radio at the Horse Racing Radio Network like 10 years later, a little over 9 years later, and found my way to Naira, and it's been
became the legend of the air during that time.
I'm sorry?
I think that was really where you became widely known, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, it was regional, not that it was regional in New York, and, you know, I've been around the racetrack my whole life, so all the trainers, and I remember when the sports editor at the Post,
yeah,
Greg Gallo.
Yeah, inside the industry knew you.
Yeah, like when Greg Gallo gave me my interview, I was basically like, I don't know how to turn a computer on, I've never had a job in my life, but we can call any trainers you want right now, and they will give you a stamp of approval on me, and he picked Hall of Famer Bill Mott, who less than a year earlier was at said college graduation party, and the late, great Alan Jerkins. And, I mean, you could argue that those are the two best horse trainers of all time. And Alan was like a grandfather to me. So the two names he picked were – he couldn't have picked two better names, not only because of their clout,
people that love
and their
you.
Legendary status, but they were two people who, you know, I had – Alan was like a grandfather. You know, Bill always treated me very, very well to this day. Bill, you know – professionally, personally and professionally, will never say no to me, you know, do interviews whenever I needed them. So, yeah, you know, in the industry, kind of known just because I was a fat little racetrack kid running around Aqueduct and Belmont when I was young. And then, yeah, HRN, I kind of got exposed a little bit to the national audience, and it kind of just took off.
Continues to this day. So where do you see the sport today? Good, bad, or indifferent, where do you see it going?
I think we did a pretty good job as an industry. And I hate to say this because personally, and I don't have to tell you because our relationship began because of HRRN and one of the companies you used to work for. But personally, COVID ruined me. I think it really helped the horse racing industry, because when all the other sports shut down, and this is one of the things I'm probably proudest of with my time at HRN and being in the horse racing industry period, there was a thoroughbred race run every day of the year except Christmas, which we don't, nobody runs on Christmas anymore. There was a thoroughbred race run every day of the year except Christmas in 2020, when every major sport had to adjust, cancel, and postpone games and major events. And we never stopped. And I think we did a good job not only getting more people to watch it, but quite frankly, you know, when it comes down to the dollars and cents, to bet on it. I think we were able to get some money from sports gamblers, from poker players. You know, a lot of things, you couldn't go to a poker room and sit down and play Texas Hold'em.
So cut to
I know
today,
because I used to play. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. Sorry.
You know, I used to play in two house games. We, you know, I had a card game I played in for 9 years every night on a Tuesday. We didn't play for like 7 months because, you know, I was dealing with some older gentlemen and some guys with health issues. Like,
and everybody's unsure. Yeah.
Yeah. And nobody, you know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of people were unsure and, you know, not, didn't feel safe. So we had those races on Fox and, you know, we kept the shows going. And then, you know, we didn't miss a show on HRRN. And it was something that I think it gave people who were never exposed to the business this sense of, well, everything else left, a lot of entertainment left, and a lot of our options to occupy our minds during this were gone. But man, this horse racing was on every day. So I think it gave people a bit of a reassurance that, hey, if something really bad happens, we're still going to be here. And I think we did a pretty good job capitalizing on that. Could we have done better? Yeah, everybody could do better. Nobody ever does exactly what they need to or should. Could we have done a better job? Probably. We could have did a better job holding on to some of those people. But for the most
part,
I think
they
stuck around.
So cut to today, do you think that it – I mean, there's a lot of controversy. People – I mean, it's no secret. There's – looking at it from the outside in, people feel like – and I hear this from a lot of people, that they feel like the industry is almost eating itself. It seems like there's so much internal.
Well, as we sit here, I can tell you that I'm watching the Saratoga Live program, which is currently on Fox Sports 2. It'll move to Fox Sports 1 a little later on in the day. I can go down 12 channels and go to the competitor, and I could watch racing literally all day and night long. I do believe we did a pretty good job at keeping a bulk of these people. Did we keep them all? Probably not. But that was bound to happen, right? Especially if you're a gambler, like not only are you a creature of habit as a gambler, but you want to do what you're more comfortable doing. So they went back
and
to
there's
sports.
A,
went
there's
back
a to wider poker. Menu. You know, there's a wider menu.
And there's a wider menu, yeah, of course. Right. You know, the races get run every 22, 23 minutes, 25 minutes, Saratoga 30 minutes. But, you know, for the people who say, well, the game's in trouble, I'll present the fact that there's a network that shows horse racing every day that's available with almost every basic cable channel. At the very least, you pay a few more bucks a month to get the sports channel. You can go on your phone and watch races from around the world on a regular basis. And the family of Fox Sports in conjunction with NYRA, you know, Saratoga wraps up tomorrow. It's the best racing meet in the country, if not the world. It was 39 days this year. There was one day they had to cancel.
This had to be one of the biggest meets for them, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was big.
Yeah.
220 hours on the family of Fox networks, including 6 Sundays. For 3 hours on Big Fox on the national network, right? The Kentucky, I'll give it to you in context. 40 years ago, 35 years ago, when the Kentucky Derby was being run, the contracts were held by ABC. They would take 15 minutes on Wide World of Sports, and I'm dating myself a little bit here. I'm 47. I know I'm dealing with a lot of people that are older than me, especially in this business, but they would give them 15 minutes on Wide World of Sports. between radio and TV coverage, live and recorded, there's close to 45 hours of coverage of the Kentucky Derby every year. Probably cuts in half for the Preakness, and depending on what's happening as far as the Triple Crown, goes back to the 40 for the Belmont Stakes. You have the Breeders' Cup. So these things that have not worn around 30, 40 years ago are not only here, but they're thriving.
That's good to hear. I mean, you wonder sometimes, and I have a lot of people that ask me, they're like, you know, do you think horse racing is going to survive? Because the other side of it is, you know, it felt, you know, if you go back, and now I'm dating myself, but if you look at, like, Hollywood going back to, you know, the 40s and 50s, horse racing was like in a reference in almost every show. I mean, you couldn't turn a comedy or a sitcom on or even a movie without hearing some reference to Santa Anita or Belmont or, you know, something to do with the industry. And it felt like that kind of went away for a while. And, you know, hopefully that does, you know, get stronger again to where it becomes more a part of the society.
Yeah, I think it will. I think it will.
So what's next for Big A? Where do you go? Finger Lakes, obviously. And then
I'll get my call. I've got my call 4:30 in the morning after Phyllis is making a big little barbecue here for Labor Day weekend. I hope everybody has an enjoyable and safe Labor Day.
Are you live racing tomorrow?
We live race every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday through. Yeah, that's the one thing about the horse racing industry. We don't take holidays off. Like other sports, we don't take holidays off. So all my friends will be gouging themselves tomorrow. I will have a little, we got $2 hot dogs and $1 sodas and waters tomorrow at Finger Lakes. That's the big promotion. And we got the Arctic Queen Stakes race.
And for anybody it's a great way to spend a holiday. I know my kids and I have spent several Thanksgivings at Churchill Downs,
yeah.
A lot of Christmas vacations around Gulfstream, and a lot of spring breaks around Keeneland. So it is a great way to spend a holiday weekend.
And getting the kids involved, one of my favorite gigs, in my time at NYRA, I hosted the breakfast programs at both Belmont Park and Saratoga.
I remember
getting getting the young kids involved and getting, you know, the casual fan involved is one of my favorite things. I'm a promoter and I'm a talker and I'm a promoter. And I love trying to get the next generation to get involved in what I think is the greatest game they play outdoors.
And I think that's important. I mean, I think that needs more of that. I mean, guys like us can't be the youngest guys at the track.
I agree, and I think you're seeing. I think this Fox Sports show has really helped that. I think
Belmont will really help that too when it opens back up, because that's going to be
Belmont. A new Belmont will certainly help that as well. They're going to make it a little bit more high tech and a little bit more fan friendly. So, yeah, I think, you know, these things. There's been a lot of change in the industry, especially the last 20 years, and I'm not the biggest fan of change. As I get older, I think my generation is probably the first generation that, even if we don't like it, we're more willing to embrace it. Like my mom and that generation, she's not willing to change. There's no willingness there. But I think, you know, I've come to the conclusion that I've been out in the business world enough now and worked for enough places and racetracks where you see that it's, you know, it's not, people say the sport of kings. Well, it's kind of become equally a business, and it kind of sucks that it's equally become a business, but there's a lot of competition out there for the wagering dollar, not only between racetracks but other sports, with all of the sports betting becoming legal now, and, you know, in all of these states, and everything's at the touch of a phone, of a device, a laptop, a tablet. So, you know, you got to change and adapt, or, you know, it's not going to thrive. But I think we've done a good job doing that.
Well, and I think, in a way, and I understand what you're saying, you know, becoming a business. But in another way, I think becoming a business, or looking at it more as a business, also is going to lead to the longevity of it. And I guess what I would point to is, when you look at it, the NFL is a business, Major League Baseball is a business, and they make no bones about that. So there's no reason this industry shouldn't be.
Yeah, no, you know, I think it's just.
I think it's a, you know, I really would like to see it thrive. I mean, I felt like it, you know, I obviously didn't grow up in it. I feel like it, you know, in the time that I've been around it, which has pretty much been since like 2010 up, but I felt like I saw it peak and then it kind of backed off and now it's kind of trying to come back. And, you know, I really hope that Belmont lends itself to maybe re-energizing part of that. I think Saratoga kind of re-energized some of it this summer. I think people really enjoyed having that longer meet up there. I think it was kind of fun to have the Belmont there. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's two sides to that. You know, it's always odd not to have it where it's at, you know, the Belmont at Belmont. But in another sense, it was almost like, you know, doing something fun for like a vacation or something.
Yeah, well, we'll get to do it again at least next year because it'll be back next year and it might even be back the following year. So well,
when
you know,
is Belmont supposed to open?
They're hoping for sometime in 2026. But I don't,
so,
for
people who don't know, we're talking to Anthony Big Ace DeBeal. He's the announcer for Finger Lakes and been actively involved in horse racing his whole life. Talking about Belmont a little bit, tell us, for people that aren't aware of it, what that's going to be. I mean, we knew what it was, but what's the next, like when it reopens, what does it become?
I mean, it's going to be a state-of-the-art facility. The old building was so enormous. It was over 100. It was over 1 million square feet. And this one's going to be about 340, I believe. So,
oh, wow.
Maybe a little less. I think it's about a quarter of the size of the old place.
And yet it's going to have more things in it, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Well, it'll be updated. Yeah, the last time they renovated the old Belmont Park, it's not longer. It doesn't stand anymore. It was in the 60s. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot more modern. You're going to see a lot more bells and whistles. And, you know, they're building shopping across the street. The New York Islanders Arena, the UBS Arena is right next door. You know, so they have the concerts and they have the circus for the kids. And, you know, they have all the events that come in. And, you know, I'm sure they'll incorporate that a lot more with Belmont Park. You know, we have at least 40 hockey games a year with the Islanders, and they do a great job with concerts. It's a great place to see a show. I've seen a couple of concerts. I've seen Andrea Bocelli there. I've seen New Kids on the Block there. I went to a WWE event there. And all of the events have been fantastic, great sound systems. They have people come in and out of there. And, you know, as the new building opens and those shops across the street are open, it's going to be an entertainment destination, much like, you know, they've done at Gulfstream Park. But I think we'll do a little bit of a better job keeping the tradition of racing here, because the building itself will still be standalone. The building itself will still be, you know, the new building will be where the old building was, and the racetrack surfaces, while they're getting redone, they're not being changed. They're adding an all-weather, a tapeta surface for winter racing, so we don't lose as many horses as we do ordinarily in the winter months. And that's come with a little, with some reservations and with some objections. But again, got to kind of change and adapt, or, you know, you don't move forward. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how, when everything settles in, if we're able to get some new folks and maybe, you know, grow some the fan base and get some new fans in here that way.
That's really great. Anything you want to plug coming up? Anything you're hosting or promoting that you want to talk about?
No, just, you know, Finger Lakes. We have a fun little meet up there going still. We have 13 weeks left. We run Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, post times 1 o'clock for September, the entire month of September, 1 o'clock post. And this time of year now, when some of these other places close on Mondays and Tuesdays, we're kind of the only game in town. So still deal with some Kentucky racing on Wednesdays. But in New York State, we're the only thoroughbred game in town Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. 1 o'clock.
And frankly, in Cleveland area or upstate New York or northeast Ohio, it's not far and a good way to spend a day.
And if you're a racetrack fan, it's got that old racetrack feel to it. Like, you feel like you're at the track. It's a lot. And, you know, as we just get done talking about how Belmont's going to become a state-of-the-art entertainment facility, the new one, Yeah, you get that old racetrack feel to it. You know, like I said, tomorrow we got $2 hot dogs and dollar sodas. Like, the concessions were in there. I remember the gal that works the teletimer machine. My friend Angie came up one day, and my lunch, I missed my lunch or whatever it was, and I was like, I could really go for a hot pretzel. I was like, you know, and I got a bum hip, so she ran down for us, and I was like, here, take, you know, buy yourself, you know, get lunch on me. I gave her a $20 bill, and I said to her, is this enough? And she just started laughing at me. So she came up, and she had, like, a slice of pizza for herself and a pretzel for me, and it was, like, $5.50 gone. I was like, did you take yours out of here, too? She's like, yeah. And I was just like, oh, wow. You know, because we're used to being down here in the city and charging, getting charged $8 just for the pretzel. So it's nice. It's got that little fun feel to it. They have a little patch of grass on the clubhouse turn as well, which is something that endeared me to the place immediately. And Memorial Day, 4th of July. 4th of July, we had a great celebration of Funny Side, who passed away last year. He actually finished off his career 17 years ago on Independence Day at Finger Lakes in the Wadsworth Handicap. And his ownership group was made up of a half a dozen or so folks that were all from upstate, nearby Finger Lakes and Sackett's Harbor. That's why Saratoga Stable got his name, Sackett's Harbor and Saratoga. So,
friends,
that was a fun day.
Derby hat and derby pin.
Yeah, I have all the stuff, too. I was his ghostwriter for the New York Post. It was one of my favorite gigs of all time. I was his ghostwriter between the Preakness and the Belmont Stakes when he was trying to win the Triple Crown. So, you know, days like those. But tomorrow, I'm expecting, it's supposed to be 70 degrees tomorrow. Sunny and 70. Beautiful day. You know, you got the $2 hot dogs. There's a jockey foot race to benefit the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. We're going to raise about $2,500 for the PDJF tomorrow. There's a chance for the folks to win $250. No money up, just by picking who they think is going to win the foot race. And then multiple entries, we'll just have a blind drawing for the winner. Yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff out there tomorrow. So if you're in that, like Mark said, if you're in that area, we're about 15
or if you're looking
miles
for a destination. So I can honestly say I've been there. So as you well know, my kids and I would road trip to Saratoga many years in a row. And we would cruise right through there coming from Michigan, headed to upstate New York. And that was always one of the stops just because it was along the way and something to do to break up the trip.
Yeah, fun place. A lot of wineries and stuff around there. I stay in a town of Victor. It's right next to Farmington. It's just north of Farmington. And you have one of the busiest lakes in the country there, Lake Canandaigua. You know, you're right there on the Finger Lakes. You're not far from the Great Lakes. You're an hour and a half from Buffalo. And the wineries and the breweries are fantastic in the area. Everybody raves about them. So I'm not much of a wine guy, and I'm trying to stay away from trying to get some weight off so I can get my hip replaced. So I'm trying to stay away from the bourbon and the whiskey, and the beer. But yeah, they got a lot of good stuff up there too.
But never the pasta and the garlic knots.
Oh, that's impossible.
Exactly. We are Italian. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate you joining the show, and I definitely want to have you back again. Talk a little bit more about Howard Beach Racing, and there's a million different subjects we can wander through.
We'll talk real soon. It was great being. It was a real pleasure being a part of this today.
Yeah, can't thank you enough, Anthony Big Ace DeBeal. If you're anywhere near Finger Lakes, or if you want to listen to a race that's called very well and kind of like he said, you know, takes you back to a true race tech experience, dial up Finger Lakes. You can listen to it online. You can watch it on several different networks. I want to thank the devil for joining us. Any last political things you want to add in as the voters are starting to figure out what they want to do?
Not really. I just kind of nodded off there a little bit. I'm not really into the whole horse racing thing or whatever it is. The last time I dabbled in it, Christopher Reeves.
Was that your work?
That was my handiwork there. I got a lot of flack from it, and I'm like, you know, maybe it's not my thing. So I guess I'll flip over to NASCAR, see what I can do there.
Yeah, they seem like they could use your help.
They seem a lot faster, a lot more violent. I mean, lots of people that fall off a stupid horse and get back up. I mean, that's actually an expression.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, you don't want to see that in horse racing, though. It's not a good day.
What's that, cars?
Falling off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, falling off in the app. But, I don't know, man. It's just another left turn.
You got a lot going on this year.
Yeah, it's been busy. You know, I've been working hand-in-hand with some of the major news networks. Trump and this whole
year.
Betterment of the country. We're not having that. I'm going to torpedo that.
Every I can see that.
The way I possibly can. I think Kamala's doing an excellent job.
I figured she was your girl.
She is. Yeah. One of her interviews the other, well, I guess she has technically had it in it. Well, you know what?
I haven't seen her answer a question, no, but that's just, I don't pay attention to politics like you do.
Yeah, well, she's busy. You know, she's got a lot of,
I mean, it must take a lot of time to working on a laugh like that.
That was actually some handiwork, one of my demons we tried.
That makes sense. Well, you know, we appreciate everybody joining us. From the devil to Ryan Newman, Big A, Anthony Stabile, this is Hollywood and Horsepower. We appreciate everybody joining us and look forward to talking to you again soon. Goodbye, everybody.